This is Digital Dave for EAA Radio, and I'm speaking with
Dean Alexander
of the National Park Service, correct?
That's correct.
And we're standing in front of a 1928 Fairchild FC2W2, which if I didn't have that poster there, I'd have no clue what it was.
That's right. It's a fairly rare aircraft. This example, there may be two or three examples in museums. This is the only airworthy example left. And it flew in here on Sunday.
I was going to say, I'm gathering it flew in here because I see the oil dry underneath the engine.
It is a radial engine.
Now, talk to me about the history of this particular airplane.
This airplane, as you mentioned, was manufactured in 1928. The original owner was the National Advisory Council on Aeronautics, which was the forerunner of NASA. NACA became NASA in 1958. So this is the first airplane NACA bought. So it's kind of NASA's first airplane.
I bet they'd like to have it back.
The owner has repainted it in its National Park Service colors. Then he found out it was the NACA's first airplane.
Uh-oh.
And then he kind of regretted his choice. But we like the color scheme that he has.
It's beautiful black and yellow.
Black and yellow.
One interesting thing I noted is its folding wing.
Yes. Kind of in common with a lot of golden age of flight aircraft. They had folding wings to facilitate storage. And also, if you broke down and couldn't get the airplane fixed, you could always tow it.
Okay, and maybe if you were shipping it across the Atlantic or
shipping it across the Atlantic, you could certainly fold it up for that as well.
Okay, now, first NACA had it.
Right.
And you said they finished up and they transferred it to the Park Service.
Park Service.
At that time, was the Park Service looking for an airplane?
Well, it was the first Park Service airplane. They actually had a fairly unique role for this airplane. This was back in the Depression when the Park Service got it. They just opened the CCC camps, Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yes.
And several of the camps were spread out along the Outer Banks. And there weren't exactly roads between all the islands and the Outer Banks back then. So they needed a way to get, you know, the milk and the bread and the VIPs and the sick people in and out from those camps. And that's the role that this airplane performed.
So it was camp support.
Right.
It was pretty much a do whatever we can think of at the time.
Right.
But nowadays, you think of the Park Service flying airplanes more to track wildlife and count populations and things like that.
Yeah, we use them for several roles. Probably the biggest role is to patrol really large natural areas. So most of our aviation fleet's actually up in Alaska. And we have these huge parks with just a few employees, and the only way practically to patrol that much area is with an airplane. So, you know, we use PA-18s and Huskies and aircraft like that to patrol those large wilderness areas.
Well, not only do you want to patrol, but you also want to be able to land when you find something.
Or at least get somewhat close to it.
Okay.
We also use the aircraft in search and rescue. As you mentioned, we also use it in wildlife tracking. You know, the airplane we had down here from Voyager National Park last year had the antenna on the outer wings for tracking radio collars that you put on wildlife and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
No, we don't do that.
Only if they ask.
Right.
But anyway, how many years was this particular airplane in Park Service use?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
Okay.
I do know that after the Park Service finished with it, it was transferred to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And was used out on the Navajo Reservation, which is how it got into the Far West. It was then sold into private ownership, and was being used as a, you know, bush plane utility transport kind of thing. When the owner, the current owner, spotted it out in the Yellowstone Basin, and purchased it out there.
So it's had a long and checkered history. It's actually a very large airplane.
Yes, it is.
I don't know how many people it can carry. It looks like four,
five. Five. It has five seats. But I think you really needed to be kind of thin.
Small.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't see myself crawling in the back too easily.
Well, it does have back doors.
Oh, I see that. I see that now. So, and you guys bring this, well, the owner loans it to you.
The owner loans it to us. The owner is Greg Herrick of Golden Wings, the Golden Wings Aviation Museum out of the Twin Cities.
Okay.
Who was a former Park Service seasonal ranger. And so, you know, we got a little soft spot on him there.
Yeah, that's probably why he gave you your paint job.
Right, maybe, yeah. you know, several years running, he's been bringing it down, letting us put on display.
I'm sure it draws a lot of interest.
Right, and you know, it's an interesting artifact for the Park Service. You know, we certainly have a lot of sentimental attachment to it.
So they've been using aircraft ever since.
We've been using aircraft ever since. And, in fact, one of the more ironic stories is one of the early Park Service pilots was a guy by the name of Roy Nabishu, K and whatever, right? And he was actually the Wright Company exhibition team manager back in 1910. By the 1930s, you know, he was looking for a job and got a job flying for the Park Service. And ironically, the Park Service then has a park in Dayton at Huffman Prairie where he worked with the exhibition team now.
So he's still working for the Park Service, you could say.
Yeah, well, we're still telling his story.
Yep, well, that's pretty cool. Pretty cool. I'm trying to think of what else I'd like to ask you, and my mind is going blank.
Well, I just want to, you know, the Park Service, in addition to being a user of aviation, we also maintain some of the most important historic sites in the history of aviation. You know, we manage sites associated with the Wright brothers in Dayton and in Kitty Hawk. You know, we own, manage, protect, preserve for the American people, you know, the site of the first flight. And, you know, we own sites in the neighborhood, buildings where the Wright brothers worked.
How many are there? I mean, everybody knows about Kitty Hawk. That's where they flew.
Right.
But the airplanes were actually built in Dayton.
Built in Dayton.
And right. Huffman's Prairie was their flying field of choice when they were home?
Yes. After they... Hold on a second, sorry.
I don't think that's a Wright flyer.
Certainly got my curiosity up.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know what that was. It wasn't this Fairchild either.
No. After they finished the flights in 1903 out at Kitty Hawk, they felt they needed someplace closer to home to work. So they leased a cow pasture that was kind of out of the way but still on the railroad line. It's at Huffman Prairie, which is now part of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So ironically, you know, one of the first places where people learn to fly and experiment with airplanes is now the headquarters of the Air Force Materiel Command, which is responsible for developing airplanes for the Air Force.
And I imagine that's kind of a footnote. Is there any monument there at the actual field?
Oh, yeah, there is.
Okay.
The field's preserved. There are replica hangars from their 1905 flying season. The public has access to the field almost every day. And we have a visitor center on a hill overlooking the site. And people can come and visit us and go out and visit the field. And... hopefully,
I can't wait to go because I've never been to Dayton, and I definitely want to get out there.
Well,
there's so many big museums and important things.
Right. Huffman Prairie is also one of the sites of one of the earliest flying schools in the United States. In fact, this is a centennial of the Wright brothers opening their flying school.
And they actually called it the Wright Flying School, I imagine.
They did.
Imagine
Wright Company Flying School. Buy an airplane, get free instruction.
There you go. I also understand that they actually did campaign an air show team, if you want to call it that.
They did. The Wright Exhibition Company team. I told you about Roy Nabishu.
Right.
He was the manager of the team. And for about 2 years, they would go around the country flying airplanes at public events. Their first event was actually at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
That's got to be a hard course to fly.
Yeah.
And I know I couldn't do it with that thing there.
No.
By then, their airplanes had gotten better, and that's the one thing that impressed me with flying the simulator. Okay.
It's an F4 Phantom.
Sure is. I couldn't figure it out because of the angle there for a second. I remember those as a kid. The one thing that impressed me when we were there for the 03 flight, the reenactment, is how marginal that airplane was.
It flew, but just barely. It's extremely marginal. Had about a 12-horsepower engine on it.
A heavy 12-horsepower engine by today's standards.
Well, probably by today's standards, that's
yeah.
True. But by the standards of the time, it was actually pretty lightweight because it was in one of the original aluminum block engines. But the secret that the Wright brothers had, that, say, Samuel Langley. Samuel Langley had a 50-horsepower engine, but the Wright brothers got more thrust out of their 12-horsepower because they had more efficient propellers.
That's another thing I recall reading, too, is that when they did wind tunnel testing on some of the original Wright props, they were amazed at how efficient they were.
Yeah, they're about 80% efficient, and even today, you know, it's unusual to get a prop that's, you know, any more than 85% efficient.
You wonder how they did it. Yeah. How they figured
all
actually, that out.
Well, actually, it was part of their scientific thinking process. They had the insight to realize that a propeller is just a wing turned on its side. And so the same lift and drag tables that they developed for the airfoil, they applied to the prop.
It all worked out to our advantage.
Yes, it did.
And then GE came along and put a jet engine on top of the Wright Flyer. That's a different story. All right, I want to thank you for talking with us, Dean.
No problem. Thank you.
Have a great time here at Oshkosh. Is this your first trip?
No. I've been an EAA member since the 80s.
Oh, wow. You got me beat.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
This is Digital Dave.